ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
They prayed, they preached, they rebelled. From God Forbid, this is the Religious Rebels podcast, the stories of people who defied empires and sometimes paid with their lives. From Joan of Arc's battlefield visions to Malcolm X's final revelation, we tell the stories of those who defied faith and remade it. Religious Rebels, the original disruptors. Search for God Forbid ABC wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
Humanity has always been engaged in this constant battle for power, for equality, but somehow in the modern public sphere, many causes are cast as the product of ideology or indoctrination or part of what some describe now as a woke agenda. Today on Big Ideas, the renowned British philosopher and prolific popular author A.C. Grayling pulls apart the culture wars.
There are movements, quite powerful movements, quite vocal, with a big platform, who don't want the wokists, whom they demonise by using that term, to continue to make the advances towards a society which genuinely is fair and inclusive. And that's what wokeism is about.
G'day, my name is Natasha Mitchell. This is Big Ideas, your front row seat to big thinkers at the best live events, including a favourite with ABC Radio National listeners, AC, or Anthony Grayling, author of more than 30 books on pretty much almost everything, I think, from the meaning of life to democracy to who owns the moon. His latest, Discriminations, Making Peace in the Culture Wars, takes a philosophical lens to grapple with a defining issue of our time. He is founder and principal of the New College of the Humanities at Northeastern University in London, and also its professor of philosophy. And he joins you on Big Ideas today with a special lecture that he gave at this year's Melbourne Writers' Festival. Later, he'll be joined by outgoing Meanjin editor and author Esther Anatolitis. First, though, AC starts by unpacking the origins of that curious word, woke.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. So, the culture wars, or the woke wars, as some people call them. Now, the word woke, I want to just begin with a comment on that, because it is a word which has been adopted by the more conservative side of the argument in this, the sort of right-wing side, as a word of contumely, a word of abuse, a word of mockery, a word of sort of demonization of the causes that wokeism is about. But I think that the word woke should be reclaimed and used with a certain degree of pride, because after all, it has a noble history. It has the history of originating among African Americans who were encouraging one another to be conscious of the fact that the discrimination they suffered under wasn't only the very obvious kind. I mean, if you enslaved, it's pretty obvious that you're being discriminated against, but in all sorts of other ways, hidden ways. Imagine a situation where you go to rent an apartment or apply for a bank account or for a job, or you want to get your kids into school. You might meet with smiling faces and people who seem helpful. And then when you go out of the office again, somebody else there says, oh, you know, I wouldn't let that apartment to them because there are other people nearby who wouldn't like it. I mean, that sort of thing, hidden layers of discrimination that people of colour in the United States and elsewhere, of course, have experienced. And the idea of being awake to that, of being conscious of that, and therefore of being able to deal with it and be able to challenge it, was very important. So in the argo, in the manner of speaking, the idea of being awake, being alert to these problems, translated into being woke to these problems. And therefore, what wokeism denotes is something really very, very significant, something that lies beneath all the rhetoric, all the fiery disagreements, the things that people say or do when they are particularly active on both sides of this debate, and which distract our attention, really, from this deep underlying stratum of what's really important in the woke wars. I mean, we're all conscious of the fact that on both sides of the woke wars, things are done and said by activists and by opponents, which sometimes sound very difficult to accept or very unappealing. But that's of the nature of rhetorical battles. People do get frustrated and people do get angry, and then people say and do things that can be unfortunate. But if you dig beneath them, if you think about the ideas, the principles, the causes, the reasons that give rise to these rhetorical battles, you see that there is indeed something important. And what it is this. It's about the fact that since the middle of the 20th century, there has been a tremendous endeavor on the part of people who have suffered tremendous discrimination historically and continue to suffer it, even as the second half of the 20th century unfolded, who have suffered from discrimination, from prejudice, from the refusal to allow them to have a fair place in society, a fair chance and a voice. I mean, think of this. People of color, women, gays, people who were disabled, lots of people who were marginalized and who were disregarded in society up until that point, the 1950s and 60s of the last century. Most of them did not even have the right to claim their rights. They didn't even have a voice at all with which they could voice their demand to be given an opportunity, to be given a place in society. So underneath the woke wars, this very important issue is fighting against discrimination, saying that just in virtue of being a human being, each human being has a right to be treated fairly, to have opportunities, and to be able to contribute something to the decision-making that affects them in their lives. So really, wokeness is about anti-discrimination. And people who combat the wokists, who say, oh, you know, the techniques that are used by the more active wokists are unacceptable and unjust, the people who feel that the great endeavor against discrimination should be resisted or under the fig leaf of moderation, not allowed to progress too far or too fast, are people who are not defending their own rights. After all, the wokists are claiming their rights. The anti-wokists are defending their interests. They're defending the privilege that they have or the greater access that they have to social goods, things like quality healthcare and education, contacts, the ability to access those aspects of the economic and social order, which traditionally had always been part of the patrimony, as it were, of people who had, as a result of their ethnicity, as a result of the economic position of parents and grandparents and so on, had been actually rather a privileged position. It's a little bit like, a club which exists to promote the interests of its members, which provides facilities for them, you know, which has a nice swimming pool and a squash court and tennis court. And then other people say, we'd like to be a member of this club. We'd like to be able to access these facilities too. And the members of the club say, no, you can't. This is ours. Keep out. And in a way, society is a great club. And there are so many people right through the course of history who have not been members of the club. In fact, the club has always been a pretty small one with a very, very, very comfortably off group of people in it. And the people outside it, when they come knocking on the windows and on the doors, make the people on the inside of the club feel that in order to accord just the most basic human rights to those outside, that they are going to lose some of their position or some of their privilege. They regard it, in other words, as a zero-sum game. They can only have some rights if we have to give up some of our interests. And in fact, it isn't a zero-sum game, not at all. It's really just a question of recognizing that as a society moves through history and things change, and in this last 50, 70 years, in the period since the Second World War, most of the developed countries, indeed all the developed countries of the world, have been undergoing massive transitions in all sorts of ways, in the economic structures, in the political structures, but also in these social structures, in which people who beforehand had no way, really, of laying claim to a fair place have begun to do so. So cast your mind back. Cast your mind back to the 1960s. They say that if you remember being there, then you weren't there. I still have the hairstyle from then too, so I can lay claim to it now. But if you cast your mind back to the 1960s, you will remember the civil rights movement, and you will remember feminism, what's sometimes called second wave feminism. The civil rights movement in the United States of America was a movement to get rid of the Jim Crow laws, the apartheid laws that had continued to affect people of color in the southern states in the United States. Feminism was a reaction to the fact that the attempt by some of the developed societies in the 10, 15 years after the Second World War to reset to an order of expectations about the roles of men and women and family life and so on, actually seemed to people who had been really transformed by the experience of the war to be unacceptable. Given the fact, I mean, again, if you go back even further in history, look at what happened in the First World War, and remember that women played such a hugely important role in the First World War, producing armaments and working in agriculture in order to provide food. And then after the war, the suffrage movement, which of course had been going on for a decade or two before the war, said, the contribution that we've made is proof positive that we have a right to a voice. We want the vote. And so what did the British government do after the First World War? Well, it said, oh, well, okay, women aged 30 and over can have the vote. Well, this was on the sort of patronising view that at about that age and afterwards, women would be sensible enough to use their vote wisely. Perhaps by that time they were in a position to vote as their husbands required. And it wasn't really until 1928 that the voting age was equalised. And this, by the way, is a little example of how those who do have their hands on the levers of power are very reluctant to let go. They're very grudging, and these developments take time. But at any rate, the great contribution made by women in the Second World War meant that in the 50s and 60s, even all those glorious advertisements about how marvelous it is to have a washing machine and a Hoover, you may remember, didn't quite persuade all women that their place was, barefoot, pregnant, and in the kitchen, even with the washing machine. And they wanted to have more access to all the potential, all the possibilities that there are in society. Hence, the feminism of the 60s and 70s. Now, the civil rights movement and the feminist movement and the gay rights movement of the 60s, battling against homophobia, battling against the fact that right up until that time, right up until the 1960s themselves, in places like the UK, homosexual love was criminalized and people were sent to prison for it. I mean, the fact that today, as we speak, people are being hanged for being gay in places like Iran and elsewhere in the world is a terrific crime. But here I'm talking about the more developed countries where these woke movements, because that's exactly what they were, the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, the gay rights movement, all woke movements of the 60s and 70s. And they have been very, very successful. Things have changed dramatically since then for Black Americans, for women and for gays, hugely. If you look back across the landscape of these last few decades, you see how much progress was made by the wokest endeavors of those periods. And each stage of progress made against discrimination, for getting more of a place, treated more fairly, having more of a voice, each stage in that progress enabled further progress. Because as soon as you get a voice, you can ask for more of a voice. The journey is by no means over. Here we talk in the middle of the 2020s, and we see that the anti-wokists are by no means defeated and certainly haven't gone away. On the contrary, look at the United States of America. I mean, I'll be completely neutral. I won't say anything horrible about the ghastly Mr. Trump. But the whole endeavour of the Trump administration to get rid of diversity, equity, inclusion, to deny the opportunity for people to learn about how slavery and racism has functioned in American society, the endeavour to demonise certain groups of people who are seeking a fair place in society, is now really potentiated by what the Trump administration is doing. There are movements, quite powerful movements, quite vocal, with a big platform, who don't want the wokists, whom they demonize by using that term, to continue to make the advances towards a society which genuinely is fair and inclusive. And that's what wokeism is about. The woke wars of today, therefore, are another chapter in this story that really began after the mid-century, after the middle of the 20th century. First major chapter was the civil rights, feminism, gay rights movement. It flared up again, you may remember, in the 1990s over political correctness. You remember that phrase, PC? Well, that phrase also was a phrase used by the opponents of anti-discrimination endeavors, again, to ridicule it or to demonize it or to make it sound like an unfair and a bad thing. Political correctness, you know, you say, oh, that, well, if you're trying to be PC, you know, you're going over the top. It's overreach. It's silly. That effort was an effort to silence it and deflect attention from what really matters underlying it, which is the human rights of individual human beings. This episode in the woke wars that has been flaring up for the last 7, 8, 10 years maybe, that is a continuation of what happened in the 60s and 70s, what happened in the 90s. What's happening now is the unfolding, in a way, of this saga of trying to get society to be a place where discrimination is no longer a feature, a structural feature of the society. That's what it is all about. That's why it matters. That's the deeply important point that underlies whatever people say and do, whatever phrases people use, whatever the rhetoric looks like. If you think beneath it, think at the structures beneath it, see what it really is all about, and it really is all about the human rights of individuals.
Wokeism and its opponents, does it all ultimately come down to a battle over human rights? British philosopher A.C. Grayling traces the origins of today's divisive debates in his latest book, Discriminations, Making Peace in the Culture Wars. And he's our big thinker on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell. Find us, share us on the ABC Listen app. This speech is one that A.C. gave at this year's Melbourne Writers Festival. So where does this idea come from, that humans have rights?
Now that phrase, okay, so that's a little bit sort of a cliche phrase, talk about human rights, talk about human individuals. Actually, those phrases are heavily weighted. Look at the phrase human rights. Well, back in 1948, when the committee chaired by Mrs. Roosevelt, F.D. Roosevelt's widow, had come up with the draft Declaration of Human Rights, presented to the new United Nations in that year, 1948, accepted unanimously by the United Nations. And by the way, Mrs. Roosevelt's committee was a committee drawn from all around the world, so it wasn't just an American or just a European committee. They had before them, when they were drafting the Declaration of Human Rights, the empirical evidence of what really matters when one thinks about the rights of individuals. That empirical evidence was the horrors, the atrocities of the 1930s and 1940s. The millions of deaths, the destruction across the world, from Japan right the way across South Asia and Europe. The horrors of the Holocaust. All those evidences, smoking ruins of cities and the corpses of millions, indeed tens of millions of people, were the justification for coming up with the idea that a human being, no matter of what ethnicity, no matter of what gender or biological sex or color or anything or religion, no matter what, just in virtue of being a human being, has the right to life, to be given the possibility of privacy, to be able to hold opinions, be able to congregate with other people and share with them, or indeed not to congregate with other people, as the case might be, to have a voice in government, have a say in choosing government. These rights that are recorded by that declaration, and therefore in the great instruments of human rights that followed, both in the United Nations and in other respects, were all about opening a space around an individual human being so that he or she, they, could, if they have the energy and the desire, make something of their lives so that they could have a life worth living, that they could seek to make their lives meaningful, be able to share it with people they care about, no matter who those people are. This idea, the idea of the autonomy of the individual, of that little bit of space around the individual, and the respect that an individual, just being a human being, deserves unless they forfeit it by doing bad and nasty things. And if you want an idea of what a bad and nasty human being is like, well, there are plenty in history, all the way from Genghis Khan to Donald Trump. So you've got before you the evidence of what is unacceptable in society, but before you make a decision of that kind, you start, your first attitude towards another person is to give them the advantage of a good light, as Emerson famously said, we always give it a good light to a painting to see it properly. Why don't we give a good light to another human being until they overstep the mark and lose our respect? That's the idea that underlies the concept of human rights, the idea that each one of us deserves that space so that we can make of our lives and our relationships with others whom we care about good and worthwhile. And that is all that is being asked for by people who, both individually and in the groups they belong to, the communities they belong to, have been denied it. Again, look back across the great landscape of history and see how very, very few people at any epoch have really had the chance to exercise their choices, to make choices indeed about how they're going to live and with whom. Most people in history have been enslaved by circumstance or in actuality. Most people have not had a voice. Most of our ancestors lived very, very limited, local, oppressed, constrained lives and were not in a position to lay claim to something better and bigger for themselves, except in you know, we've all heard about the revolutions, Jack Kay's revolution or the French Revolution or whatever it might be. Those are episodes of struggle, of frustration and anger, which resulted in people rising up because they could no longer bear the oppression that they lived under. Every such episode has been an episode of trying to get that space in which to breathe as a human individual. And that is exactly what the Woke Wars is about today, as a chapter in this great change. This, in fact, has been a really positive set of developments since the middle of the 20th century in that direction. Now, of course, certain things become salient, certain things get picked on and become occupants of the horizon of debate in these matters. Everybody hears the phrase cancel culture. Everybody hears about no platforming and freedom of expression problems. And then, of course, we see how incredibly successful the far right and the conservative backlash against wokeism has been in picking on a particular issue in the woke wars and making a huge fuss about it in order to distract attention, to attack the most vulnerable and fragile group of people who want to just have a chance to be themselves and to live in the way that they choose. And that is the transgender issue. And there is empirical evidence for this right out in the public domain. Back in 2015, the Supreme Court in the United States of America confirmed the legitimacy of same-sex marriage. And prior to that time, for quite a long time, in fact, there had been a number of organizations, but in particular, one very big, powerful, and well-funded organization called the American Principles Project, the APP, which was a Christian right organization, with billions of dollars behind it, fighting against same-sex marriage. They didn't want it to happen. They fought it all the way through the courts, fought it all the way up to the Supreme Court, and they lost. Now, you can go and look at the history of the American Principles Project, and you will see that the CEO of the APP, after that Supreme Court decision, said, well, we've lost that one. Now we are going to pivot, and we're going to focus our attention on the transgender issue. And they have been incredibly successful in making it so salient. Now, just think of this, okay? People who are uncomfortable with how expectations and birth assignments and so on want them to live and how they express themselves, and who want to be something different or present themselves differently in society and in their relationships, are, in overall terms, in world population terms, a very small number of people. For each one of them individually, things matter greatly to them. It's important to them, and they deserve our respect and concern. There's no question about it. However, the transgender community, or people who have some form of gender dysphoria, are something less than perhaps 1% of the world population. And yet you would think that they were all lurking around the corner with knives drawn ready for you as you try to make your way to the tram, okay? And this is because of the success of the fact that the degree of attention focused on them and the way that it's been blown up into a huge issue. Not only blown up into a huge issue, but the people who are against wokeism in general and who have picked this issue as the one where they think they can do most damage to all wokeism by association, they've even succeeded in setting feminists against one another. And this is the beauty of their attack, because if you can get your enemies to start treating one another as enemies and start arguing with one another, well, then you can sit back and just enjoy the view and you don't have to put in too much effort. And they've certainly succeeded in doing that, haven't they? So it has become a painful and a difficult internecine battle among people, feminists, who still have a lot of work to do to make sure that women really do get a fair shot in our developed societies, because they still don't. 56% of university graduates in the United States of America are women, and it's a hell of a lot less of a percentage of women who are in boardrooms and at the top of organizations and generals in the army. So something is happening there, which shows you that there is still work to be done to get genuine fairness in society. But this is an issue where the anti-wokists have found a lever that they can pull and pull and pull, cause a lot of debate and a lot of fuss, distract attention, and by association, demonize everybody else. It's not easy for the right, not even, you know, the Trumpists, to go full frontal on sexism and racism. I mean, they do sometimes, and you know, so that's obvious enough. But if you can draw attention away onto a more vulnerable group, easier to attack because, of course, our assumptions about binaries and about traditions and the rest of it are much easier for them to invoke. And people who don't think much about these matters, and I'm afraid to say that that is most people outside this room, okay, tend not to think too deeply about these matters. You've all heard the saying, Bertrand Russell, you know, most people would rather die than think, and most people do. Well, that's the situation in the world at large. And because they're not thinking very deeply about the issues, they can be co-opted into thinking, oh, these people say such absurd things and it's so stupid. And men are men and women are women, and that's the end of it. And they can therefore be distracted down to that issue. So you say, this transgender issue is kind of paradigmatic wokeism. So if somebody is wokeist about racism or about sexism or about gay rights, then, of course, they're tarred with the same brush. They're demonized as well. So that's really where what it comes down to. And I think that it's tremendously important, because, after all, this is the day job, you know, when you're a philosopher, you know, there's still this business. You have to think about what ideas are yeasting away in all these debates. What is it that people are thinking? What do they believe? Do they really understand the concepts that are in play? And I will remind you of a lovely story that Plato tells, one of his dialogues, about a very rich, very handsome young man who visits Athens from one of the other Greek city-states, and he wants to meet Socrates. You may remember those days there wasn't a lot of footy and telly in the evening, so the great pleasure for visitors was to go along and have a debate with Socrates under an olive tree. And he wanted to ask Socrates a really burning question. And the question was, is virtue teachable? That is, are the parents of children in our Greek city-states able to pass on their sense of righteousness and good behavior to their offspring? And the reason he asked this question was that these ancient Greek teenagers were all drinking too much ouzo, staying out late at night, stealing chariots, doing wheelies around the city, getting pregnant and so on. I mean, we can thank our lucky stars we don't live in ancient Greece. But see, he wanted to ask Socrates this question, is virtue teachable? And Socrates, you may remember, said, I don't know. And this man, his name was Meno, was flabbergasted. He said, what do you mean you don't know? I mean, you're Socrates, surely, you know. Socrates said, well, I don't know what virtue is. Because I don't know whether virtue is teachable, because I don't know the more fundamental thing, which is what virtue itself is. Now, that really flabbered Meno's ghast, you know, because he thought he had come to the oracle. So he said, well, I'm astonished you don't know what virtue is. Socrates said, well, do you know what it is? Meno said, of course I do. Socrates said, oh, good, I've been looking for somebody all my life who does, tell me. So Meno tried a definition, because he hadn't really thought about it, you see, so he was a bit, you know, taken aback here. It was a bit of a fast, pitched-up ball, this one, on a sticky wicket. So he came up with a definition, and Socrates said, can't be that. Gave him a reason why not. Meno was a bit taken aback. He tried again. That didn't work either. Socrates showed him that he wasn't thinking straight. Finally, Meno said, oh, Socrates, you're like a stingray. You've stung my lips and tongue, and I don't know what to say. Socrates said, good. Now that you know you don't know what you're talking about, we can make some progress. And this, of course, is the great aspiration of anybody who aspires to study and teach and write about philosophy, is to try to make that little bit of progress by just clarifying things, just making it clear what's really at issue. And that is why in something which is, you know, so provocative and so tumultuous as the woke wars sometimes are, and the kind of knee-jerk reaction to hearing things that wokers say or that anti-wokers say, the degree to which we are just exposed to the top layer of rhetoric where really very odd things are said and done and not looking at the ideas underneath it, that is where we need to go and to provide clarity. And when you see, therefore, this is my point, that the clear point is, this is about human rights. This is about fairness. Human rights are powerfully justified by the evidence that we have for the lack of human rights in society. We've seen it in the 40s and 50s. We see it today, alas, in the Middle East and in too many places in our world. We see how people suffer if they're not just treated as any individual human being should be treated. And if that were to be applied in the case of the woke wars, the problem would be over. If each human being on the planet accorded every other human being on the planet their due claim to be treated according to the most basic and simple human rights, there would be no discrimination. What would we then have? What we would then have is what I borrow from a description of the situation in the Iberian Peninsula in medieval times, in the Spain of the medieval era, when Muslims and Christians and Jews lived together, worked together, cooperated, perhaps even intermarried, taught one another, learned from one another, a period of time when the three very different communities got on with one another because they accepted one another and they were tolerant of one another. They were friends with one another. And that period in history is called the period of convivencia. It's a very, very beautiful word when you think about it. Convivencia, the ability to live together. That is all that wokists are asking for. That is what wokism is about. It's about achieving convivencia eventually. And all the distractions, all the stuff about cancel culture and about attacks on freedom of expression are actually part of the sort of heat and smoke that's given off by something which underneath it is the result of people seeking their rights and other people denying them that because they feel that their interests are threatened. And by the way, Cancel culture is the story of all human history. I mean, there have always been one group of people trying to cancel another group of people. That's what war is. You know, war is an attempt to cancel. Societies have accepted that we have to cancel some people. Criminals, we lock them up in prison. That's a form of cancellation. Sometimes society, sections of society, have cancelled people very unfairly. I use the example of Oscar Wilde, who was, you know, pretty firmly cancelled entirely by Victorian society. I mean, after all, he was sent to prison for 2 years for having violated very recently adopted laws against homosexuality. But 2 years in prison wasn't enough for society. Oh, no. They really had to get rid of him. They really had to cancel him properly. And so he had to go into exile and died very soon afterwards. So, you know, so cancelling has worked both ways. What Trump is doing in America now is a massive cancelling endeavor against people and movements who are trying to argue for individual human rights. People on the woke side have done some cancelling. In fact, I've been cancelled by that champion of freedom of expression, Elon Musk, has thrown me off Twitter. So we, you know, it's a bit like that battle of the tomatoes in Spain, you know, that one where everybody gets covered in tomato juice. And in the cancel culture situation, that happens. Sometimes it happens unjustly. Sometimes people are called out and challenged and should be called out and challenged, but not so drastically that they completely lose their jobs or their opportunities in society. So there are some unfair cases, but there are also some cases where people do deserve that. People who have a platform and do harm, who say harmful things, who hurt people badly, who encourage other people to continue to be prejudiced and to discriminate, they need to be challenged and called out. We've got to step up and we've got to say, we want the society to be a better place, a fairer place. We want to live in convivencia with all our brothers and sisters in the human story. And that is what the Woke Wars is about. Thank you very much.
So there you go. Can humanity again find convivencia? Philosopher AC or Anthony Grayling there, trying to make sense of the culture wars. Did he make sense to you? Email us. Love your thoughts. Bigideas at abc.net.au is how you get in touch. Natasha Mitchell with you, and AC Grayling is on Big Ideas today here on ABC Radio National and the ABC Listen app with an audience at this year's Melbourne Writers' Festival. And to unpack his thoughts a little more, Anthony is now joined in conversation with writer and former Meanjin editor Esther Anatolitis. Starting with a question about how today's culture wars compare to past times.
There's so much I want to ask you, but I'm going to start with what you were just saying, which was that we can see the history of the world as being a history of one group trying to cancel the other. And I wonder what kinds of continuities and discontinuities we can sort of draw out in this notion of cancelling, because part of me wants to think there is a really clear sense of consistency in what Anthony sets out here, and you can really see the way that conflicts across history have played out when we haven't had what we have today around globalization, around social media. But then I wonder also whether there's something different about the way that cancel culture and woke culture and culture wars plays out in our contemporary space. And I think of the deliberately destabilizing tactics and the way that they work with contemporary social media, for example, but also with that particular tactic of DAVO. Do we all know DAVO? DAVO means deny, attack, and reverse victim and offender. It comes from the experience of women either experiencing sexual assault or domestic and family and partner violence, where their experience is reversed. The perpetrator said, well, no, it's your fault, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And we can see that play out in different ways in the way that culture wars and cancel culture and wokeism, you know, we've talked about appropriation in different contexts. Anthony's just set out the way that woke has meant something different at different times. But is there also an element here, Anthony, where we have bad actors who are working in deliberately destabilizing ways, using the technologies that we have now that is different to what we've experienced before?
Yes, so the answer is on both sides of this story. So if you think back, you think about the fact that people who had some kind of power, one form of power, whether it was a king or a husband, whatever, might have used that to shut other people up and to deprive them of opportunities, to cancel them in one or another respect. And the pushback against that resulted in the rule of law, in the idea that there should be much more peaceful, just, and third-party type independent ways of adjudicating those sorts of difficulties so that the weak would not be cancelled by the strong. And that has emerged. In fact, it's a part of history that goes a long way back. If you were lately reading Livy's History of Rome, you remember that at the beginning of Book Two, he talks about how the proud and haughty Tarquins, the kings of Rome, were thrown out by the Romans, who instituted in their place the rule of law. And this is precisely the idea of a due process, of a just process. Now, there are plenty of people around who do harm and do bad things and who are oppressors and harassers and so on, and they ought to be called out. There's no question. They ought to be challenged. And some of them are so egregiously bad that they ought really to be deprived of a platform and they ought to be set to one side. And I'll give you an example. Harvey Weinstein, I think, was a person who used a position of considerable power and influence to prey on women who were ambitious to get into acting and into movies. And he got caught out pretty badly by the Me Too movement and then was convicted of rape. Now, he's an example of somebody who really does need to be called out. There are also, however, plenty of people who deserve to be challenged, deserve to be questioned, but who also, and we should have this expectation, we should also demand of them that they change, that they reform and they do better, and if necessary, make reparations. Cancelling cannot be a life sentence in every case, indiscriminately. We have to think a little bit about what's proportional, we mustn't meet injustices with injustice. We must allow that people can change. Now, we know, talking about bad actors, that there will be plenty of people who grab the nearest fig leaf and say, oh, I'm sorry, and I'll be better, and then they're not. And we know that, and we have to be alert to it. But on the other hand, we cannot make the assumption that everybody that we challenge for being racist or being sexist or for being a harasser and so on, that it's impossible for them to change, and therefore they've got to be blanked out completely. So we have to think about how to do that. And the best way to do it is to recognize that in the way that social media has really potentiated something that unfortunately has always been a feature in society, and that is mob justice, where the mob is the judge, the prosecutor, the jury, and kind of frenzy gets whipped up and people become very angry, and then there's no way back, there's no sort of remedy or repair. We need to avoid that if we can and try to do things justly and fairly, give people an opportunity to do better. I cite the example, I know I'm going on too long, Esther, but I cite the example.
Everyone's here to hear you, Anthony.
a fictional example which explores exactly this problem very well, which is Nathaniel Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter. Mm. And in that novel, he shows how furious the community in this little New England town was that Hester Prynne, the female character, had committed adultery. And it had given birth to a little girl. And they were furious with her, and they were determined to cancel her as a result. And they did it by making her sew on a scarlet letter onto her blouse, A for adulteress. In fact, the women in that community wanted her to be branded on the forehead. Now, if you think about branding somebody, and in the past, some forms of punishment did involve branding or of amputating hands and so forth. That is a life sentence. There's no way back from that. Are we a society which is happy to do that and never leave room for people to do better and be better, when actually what we want is all of us to do better and be better so that our society can be a fair one? Do we want to stop people ever coming back? I mean, I point out in the book what I think is a rather surprising example for most people, and that is the example of Osama bin Laden, who got himself cancelled by Navy SEALs Team 6, you may remember. Now, he is a very, very, very unappealing candidate for having his human rights respected, the human rights of being arrested and treated with respect and due process of law and able to mount a defence and so on. You think, no, the blighted bloody well deserved it. And they killed him and dropped his body into the Persian Gulf. And from a pragmatic point of view, that was justified by the fact that the US administration didn't want him to become a sort of martyr in Guantanamo Bay and people still, you know, sort of getting riled up again about him. That dead, he was much easier to handle than alive. So they did it on pragmatic grounds. But the question I ask is this: what does that say about the US? At that time, and remember this was during the Obama administration, the US depicted itself as a place that respects the rule of law, respects human rights, respects the idea of due process. It didn't accord any of those things to Osama bin Laden for pragmatic reasons. So it got the short-term advantages of that. But all of us have lost the longer-term advantages of living according to principle. And that applies in geopolitical matters. It applies to how terrorists are treated, even though we despise and you know, disgusted by terrorists. And it certainly ought to apply in these social issues about transgender issues or about harassers or about people who continue to receive prejudice in the form of racism and sexism. Mm.
And social media can make it very difficult in that very quick-moving space where it looks like someone is being deplatformed or it looks like their possibility of speaking or expressing themselves is being taken away. But of course, what social media had made possible, if we look at the sort of, you know, pre-Elon Musk kind of era, you know, there was a bit of a heyday, wasn't there, of social media where we were kind of genuinely meeting people and having great conversations. But also what was happening was that people, as you've been describing, Anthony, people who have not had a voice had, for the first time, the opportunity to use this kind of tool together to create awareness about something which previously had not been possible. And so when I read through the book, I want to put in an order, Anthony, for the next book, which would be kind of a catalogue, a history of resistance movements and not just those kind of, not necessarily looking at two parties as being on an equal platform, but what has been that history of using the means that are available to disenfranchised groups, discriminated groups, to be able to find that voice. I think that's another one of those points of discontinuity that I see with applying that notion of cancel culture kind of back in time, because I think there is something that is unique to now.
Well, yes, that's true, and social media is a huge factor in all this. I have to say, however, that I do think social media has been, on balance, a big, big negative in all our societies and our democracies, because even though it has given a voice to the voiceless in a way which has really helped those causes, even on the side of the voiceless, it's created silos, it's aggregated anger and frustration, it's inflamed things that really ought to be dealt with in a calmer, more rational and mature kind of way. And never forget, by the way, when one is thinking about the woke wars, that there is no symmetry between the two sides here. On the anti-woke side, that is on the sort of conservative right-wing side, what you have on the extremes, among the extremist activists on that side, you have neo-Nazis and white supremacists and misogynists and masculist influences and people who say and do terrible, hateful things. Mm. And the social media has potentiated them. And they've dug their silos, and into those silos are falling all sorts of people who, you know, just want to be told what to think. And then there's some emotional connection that they make with the sorts of things that these people say. And this deepens divisions, exacerbates the tensions, and makes the opposition in the war bitter, when really it shouldn't be bitter at all. It should be about trying to say to people, look, if you think about it, every single one of us is qua individual and qua a member of a certain community, vulnerable to being on the wrong side of some argument, that there are some other people there who want to cancel us or deny us our rights. We're all in the same boat without realizing it. And if we recognize that, but in particular, of course, if we see the great value that there is in reaching out to people and being accepting and tolerant, even of things that you yourself would never have a taste for. But why be a moralist? What's the definition of a moralist? Is the person who says, I don't like it, so you can't do it. I don't like seeing those sorts of images, so you are not allowed to look at them. You know, that's the kind of moralistic position underlies the anxiety and the nerves of those who are frightened by what wokers say when they say, we just want a fair place in society.
One last question before we thank you. Convivencia. It's a state, it's a balance, but it also strikes me as a very dynamic word and a dynamic state. When I think about it, I think of a gathering, a party, people who are having a rich set of conversations. Is that how you envision it, and why that particular term to wrap up this book?
Okay. The usual philosophical answer, yes and no. I mean, In the sense that convivencia can be convivial and pleasant in that kind of way, yes. But actually, when you dig into it, and always, you know, these debates are invitations to start digging in, thinking about it. In order to achieve convivencia in a society, there has to be a certain amount of hard work done. For one thing, one really has to understand how to handle the idea, the important idea, of freedom of expression. Now, notice this. Without freedom of expression, there cannot be, for example, law. You can't accuse, you can't defend. There can't be politics. You can't put public policy proposals, you can't challenge and criticize them. There can't be education unless you're free to put forward ideas and discuss and explore them. There can't be any kind of creativity unless artists and writers, poets, musicians are free to express themselves and offer us their view of things. Freedom of expression is absolutely fundamental, but it is not unqualified. We all know that there are certain cases when misuse of freedom of expression, irresponsible use of it, causes harm. The standard example is shouting fire in a crowded theatre like this can cause a lot of harm when there's no fire. That's an irresponsible use of freedom of expression. And now you're all asking the right question, which is, so what makes for responsible use and what counts as irresponsible use? Because now you've given a weapon to people who say, when you use your freedom of expression, oh, that's an irresponsible use, so you're not allowed to say it. Well, deciding on what's responsible and irresponsible takes work. It's got to be case by case. It needs clear and hard thought to make decisions about it. You have to accept something difficult, which is that you can't constrain people's expression in advance. You can only make sure to get remedies afterwards by challenging them on what they've done. And that means that you have to accept that we're going to be offended, each one of us, by something. Offense is not something that you can use as an excuse for shutting people up. There are plenty of people, Nazis and racists and people who come out with hate speech and misogynists and so on, who say really, really, really hateful things. And it feels very instinctive just to want to shut them up and give them no platform, no opportunity to speak. But if you do that, if you drive people underground, if you silence them, what they tend to do is to make bombs and throw them because they find no other way of expressing themselves. It's better to let them express themselves and then beat them in argument. You know, treat bad uses of free expression with better uses of free expression. This is what I'm always saying to my students, that they've got to know, they've got to be clear, they've got to have the arguments, they've got to be prepared to stand up and challenge people who say and do bad things. That's the way to make the world better and ultimately to make it a place of convivencia.
Beat them in argument. Yes, can we claw our way out of today's state of division and polarisation by actually engaging with those with whom we disagree? That was popular British philosopher A.C. Grayling with an audience at this year's Melbourne Writers' Festival and host, editor and author Esther Anatolitis. Big thanks to both of them. And you can read more in AC's book, Discriminations, Making Peace in the Culture Wars. Esther's latest is the essay When Australia Became a Republic from Monash University's In the National Interest series. Great little books. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Big Ideas is produced by Karin Zivanovits, Claire Slattery and me, with support from our sound engineering colleagues across the country, really capturing the best live events so that we can get them to you on the airwaves on ABC Radio National. Hey, thanks for your company. I'll catch you next time for more Big Ideas. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.